don't know. Let's see. So last December, some of you were there, we held a holiday party for our then sanctuary guest, Ingrid. It turned out it was also a going away party because she actually left for Boulder and Stake Sanctuary there the next morning. But most of us didn't know that at the time. That night, we only knew it as an evening for kind of community building. Thank you to all the volunteers who'd been a part of hosting Ingrid and courage boosting, just a general wonderful get together for the holidays. Ingrid had cooked pozole all day. It was like wafting still through all the social hall. It smelled so good. It was also like there were big pots of it in the social hall on the stove back there, bubbling over. Delicious. The room was filled with community members and church members. It was the perfect example of what we call that tangled blessing. Because, I mean, we were there to resist a great injustice, a tragedy, embodied in this fierce and now famous woman who had run out of options for legal residency in this place where she had lived for over half of her life and where her children were born, two children. And she decided that the best alternative to complying with the deportation order to go to a country where her life was in danger and she knew basically no one, the best alternative, she decided, was to live in what I've come to think of as church jail. Having Ingrid here for those few months, she was here from October until December, was like a daily reminder of the humanitarian crisis that we have created in our own country. A crisis that's been made worse in recent months with this implementation of the so-called zero tolerance, or also known as family separation, also known as generational trauma. Except that on that night, it was not really traumatic. It was joyous, festive, like I said, invigorating, just like regular, beautiful. It was a room of all ages and different cultures, beliefs, citizenship statuses, professions, languages. It was courageous love in practice. And it was the best of who we are. About midway through the night, I'd heard that some people had brought along a couple piñatas and we'd be ending the night with a piñata. So I had a little anxiety about the dark and the small children and the swinging at things. But I thought, well, it's an una fiesta, so qué bueno, it sounds good. That is, until someone told me that one of the piñatas was a giant Trump head. It was either Eleanor or Sean, or maybe both, that asked me when they heard about that with a certain urgency, are we really okay with that? And I confess, for a flash, I thought, maybe? And then I remembered myself, and I was like, and us? And I said, no, of course not. We cannot be ending the night by violently attacking Trump's head, even if it is just paper mache, even if it is filled with candy, as my 10-year-old told me angrily. He was so mad at me for stopping it. He still actually brings it up sometimes when we talk about Trump. It wasn't just about the candy. It wasn't fair that I wouldn't let him smash the Trump head pinata. It would have been so fun to hit it and watch it fly while the other kids cheered, maybe some grown-ups too. I know, I say, but it's not who we are. Which, most of the time, I believe. We are living in this time of profound political polarization and division. I've heard it said so often recently, I feel like it's starting to become cliche. Polarization in the U.S. is not entirely new, but there are some particular ways that it's playing out differently today. Those who've studied it say it has its roots in the impeachment of Nixon, as the Republican Party was in disarray, and so they were thinking up ways to regain their strength, ideological purity and refusal to compromise became strategies, tactics for reclaiming power. Successful tactics, it turns out. Democrats were slowish to pick up on these new patterns, but then the Clinton impeachment hearings of the 90s and then the Bush-Gore decision at the Supreme Court, and they got up to speed so that by the time Barack Obama was president, despite his sweeping rhetoric and his audacity of hope, habits were well established and the grooves of polarization were by then well worn. Most everything that you read, everyone seems to call it over and over this political polarization, but I think we all experience it as something way more than political. As the organization More in Common describes it, bitter debates that were once confined to congressional hearings and cable TV have now found their way to every part of our lives, from Facebook feeds to family living rooms. And from personal experience, I'd add, from school playgrounds and the PTA meetings to the workplace to the hospital room. It is a phenomenon that the U.S. scholar Steven Weber describes as affective polarization, which is basically, it's a heart sense, affective. It's a trend towards mutual dislike between Republicans and Democrats, starting with the politicians themselves, but then over time translating into the electorate directly. As a recent article by Stephen Marsh put it, political adversaries regard each other now as un-American. They regard each other's media, whether Fox News or the New York Times, as poison or fake news. A sizable chunk do not want their children to marry members of the opposing party. Affective polarization is a crisis that transcends Trump. If Hillary Clinton would have won the 2016 election, the underlying threat to American stability would be as real as it is today. Each side, divided by negative advertising, social media, and a primary system that encourages enthusiasm over reason, pursues ideological purity at any cost, because ideological purity is increasingly the route to power. As Melissa said earlier, today we begin this new series, Divided No More. It is a series that we planned a really long time ago, actually. It was the most obvious series of any that we do, that we'll be doing this year, because we anticipated the energy that many would feel in these final days towards Election Day. Energy or anxiety or exhaustion, maybe a mix of all of these. It is not unusual for Unitarian Universalists to be dedicated, democratically speaking, and by Democrat, you can take that to mean both the political system of democracy and also the political party, Democrat. As progressive politics and progressive religion seem to me to have an even greater correspondence than they have in the past, which is saying something. When I first came into Unitarian Universalism, I was really passionate about the need to distinguish between religious and political liberalism. I'd heard stories, maybe some of you experienced this personally, of people walking into a UU church for the first time and being confused if they had arrived at a worship service or at a local meeting of the Democratic Party. So I understood and felt a calling to work into how, what is the difference of what is our calling theologically, morally, ethically, our faith calling, rather than accidentally parroting the framework and the strategies of the political left. I admit, however, this has been somewhat more confusing over the past few years, as the sorting has reached far beyond what some quarantine space you might call politics, and instead has indicated a kind of cultural or tribal, or as Emma Green described in a recent Atlantic article, a religious ethos. Modern politics, especially on the right, has often, included a religious component. The so-called values voters, the moral majority, other false equivalencies of religiosity and Christian fundamentalism have been the story of conservative politics for most of my life. But in the past few years, another kind of religious alignment has grown, this time on the left. An alignment, actually, with those who are explicitly non-religious. So in a recent survey, nearly 30% of Democrats, and among them the most active and motivated among all the Democrats, the 30 most active, identify as unaffiliated religiously. So think about this. So this is a survey. I'm sure you've seen surveys come through. Often when they ask you about your religious affiliation, they'll say things like, are you Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, or none of the above? Or maybe you might get Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, or atheist, agnostic. So I wondered, how do Unitarian Universalists answer this question? And thus, where would we show up in this survey? So Green reports that these same non-religious, extremely enthusiastic folks are currently embracing their political identity and affiliation in ways similar to how they might otherwise embrace religious or cultural identity and practices. As Green says, this progressive political identity is basically acting as a replacement for people who maybe a generation or two before would identify first as Catholics or Jewish. The Democratic Party is going through a transformative moment of sentiment and identity. Progressive politics, then, is offering a form of meaning-making, especially for those who are disconnected from other forms of religious or ethnic identity. As she says, so much of this is wrapped up in people's ideas of who they are and where they belong. Which means in today's often isolating world, the flip side of political polarization is the fact of the factions that feed us. Factions that we love and that love us. Communities and affiliations that become in and of themselves antidotes to loneliness. Sanctuaries of mutual support and safety and, again, the belonging. I mean, it feels good, right, to repost that highly partisan meme. It feels good to get the likes about it from all your friends. It feels good to watch Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews, right? I mean, it's like gathering around a cozy campfire with your people who speak your language. I mean, there's nothing like a shared enemy to help a group bond after all, and to gain that short sense of belonging. So maybe instead of understanding this moment we're in as affective polarization, we'd be better off thinking of it as affective identification, where we are all longing for that ongoing sense of community and emotional support, a sense of belonging from those who share our same orientation. Now, with all this said, I think we should be clear that in this rising sense of polarization and division, it is an overwhelmingly white phenomenon. I mean, white people in the U.S. are more divided and polarized than ever before. I mean, for most people of color, this sense of division and danger in politics, division and danger from the other, it is old news. So that what feels like regression for some of us might actually feel more like progress for others, where white folks, or at least some, are actually finally waking up. As Marsh describes in his article, during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush years, there really wasn't much of a difference between the racial attitudes of white people in either party. But that is no longer true. According to recent surveys, half of Republicans agree that increased racial diversity would bring a mostly negative impact to American society. The Republican Party, as he writes, has become a party often of racial resentment. So that if it seems easier for Americans to see the other side as distinct from themselves, that's because it is. After the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, the public radio program Fresh Air, which I would assume many of you are familiar with, they replayed an interview from last April where Terry Gross was interviewing Derek Black. Did any of you hear it? I think it played on Tuesday, Wednesday, somewhere in there. Derek Black is a former leader in white nationalism. He's actually the son of the man who founded Stormfront, a white nationalist site. But Derek Black has since had a change of heart and now works to fight white nationalism. In the wake of the worst anti-Semitic act of violence on U.S. soil, Fresh Air replayed this conversation as many of us are trying to understand what has led to the increased power and sense of legitimacy given to forces of hatred and racism in this country, and also how to stop it. So one of the things that Black described in the interview was how white nationalists intentionally seized on Obama's presidency to speak into the unresolved and sometimes subconscious racial anxiety and racial resentment felt by many white Americans. As the interview describes, polls consistently show that 30 to 40% of white Americans believe that they experience more discrimination and more prejudice than people of color or Jews. 30 to 40% of white Americans believe they experience more discrimination and more prejudice than people of color or than Jews, which is factually incorrect by every measure that we have. But by feeding that sense of grievance and by playing to these ideas that your country's being taken away or that things are changing, self-identified white nationalists have been able to make real headway into local and even statewide elections. This week, as I was explaining to my children, or really failing at explaining to my children, the history of antisemitism, and bringing them through the history, little by little, I started to feel overwhelmed at what feels like an infinite well of unresolved trauma across human history, and the incomprehensible failure on our parts across all the generations to do real work of reconciliation and reparation. The failure of us to tell the stories so often now that we now have this a terribly underdeveloped language to even speak about the violence that we have done and that we have had done to us. As my teacher, Dr. Vincent Harding, used to say, when it comes to creating a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious, democratic society, America is still a developing nation. So when we sit with this history, I mean, let it sink in. This moment, the fact that we find ourselves in this moment, affective polarization or identification, this sorting, it is not just understandable, but predictable. I mean, there is so much human work that has been left undone, work that doesn't just go away with the passing of time, work of mending and tending, healing and transforming, holy work, spiritual work, religious work, work that asks us to step back from the political affiliation as a stand-in for religion and instead ask what our actual religion offers us and requires of us in these times and in this moment. Because while the political framework, we know it might give us a sense of belonging, it's a limited sense and one that contradicts the most central claim of our faith, this claim that we all belong to each other, all of us, this claim that we are all ultimately in this life together, interconnected, interdependent, and that salvation and liberation and healing and wholeness, these are for all of us or they are for none. And here I want to underscore that the central claim of our faith, this central claim of our faith, does not actually require that we seek common ground, but only a common humanity. John's going to speak more about this extremely complicated concept next week. someone was talking to me between the services about this exact question. I said, I don't know, Sean's going to answer that next week. This claim is not even a claim that affirms an underlying sameness across all of humanity. Rather, it is a commitment that I sometimes think of as theological self-differentiation. It is where we stubbornly refuse to let the actions of another dictate the orientation of our own heart, where we commit to seeing in the other, regardless of their actions, their words, their choices, a human. A human with a story, a human with complex and contradictory and often irrational beliefs, as all humans have, a human who loves and longs for belonging, as all humans do. It is a faith commitment that there is a through line across all of us, a connective force that cannot be undone, a connective force of love. And it is a commitment that no one, no matter what, is beyond the reach of that love and its transforming power. Most of all, it is a commitment to live out of this commitment every day. To put our energy towards making something beautiful so that the ugliness has one less place to stand. Or at least it's a commitment to try. I mean, because some days, let's be honest, it seems totally right and good that we should smash that Trump head pinata. So on those days, the commitment is to remember that the reach of love includes us too, and to receive that grace, which is sometimes the hardest part. And so then it is simply the commitment to trust that there is always so much more going on than we can see, so much more work going on than we can know or understand. And so we can only give thanks that we get to be a part of it all and keep trying to do our part in love. Amen. Amen. Blessed be.